After a false start, he said, "Well, Alan, this is a shock." "Damned right it is, but in all fairness, it does no harm to the lawsuit. I'm just glad this didn't happen the day before the trial or something crazy like that. Some real bad boys up there. They won't be so tough at trial. Damned right, Wes. I hope you nail these guys for another huge verdict." "We will." "I'm sorry, Wes. It's not your fault, Alan. We'll survive and push for a trial. You do that. We'll talk later."
"Sure."
"Say, Wes, is your cell phone nearby?"
"It's right here."
"Here's my cell number. Hang up and call me back."
When both men were off the landlines, York said, "You didn't hear this from me, okay?"
"Okay."
"The chief in-house lawyer for Litton Casualty is a guy named Ed Larimore. For 20 years, he was a partner in a New York law firm called Bradley and Backstrom. His brother is also a partner at that firm. Bradley and Backstrom does the blue chip thing, and one of its clients is KDN, the oil exploration firm whose biggest shareholder is Carl Trudeau. That's the connection. I have never talked to Ed Larimore, there's no reason to, but the supervising attorney I deal with whispered to me that a decision was made at the very top to stiff this settlement."
"A little retribution, huh?"
"Smells like it. It's nothing illegal or unethical. The insurance company decides not to settle and goes to trial. Happens every day. There's nothing you can do about it, except burn them at trial. Litton Casualty has assets of $20 billion, so they aren't worried about a jury in Pike County, Mississippi. My guess is they'll drag it out until you get to trial, then try to settle."
"I'm not sure what to say, Alan."
"I'm sorry this happened, Wes. I'm out of the picture now, and you didn't get this from me."
"Sure."
Wes stared at the wall for a long time, then mustered the energy to stand, walk, leave his office, and go look for his wife. Chapter 25. Like clockwork, Ron Fisk kissed Doreen goodbye at the front door at 6 o'clock on a Wednesday morning, then handed his overnight bag and briefcase to Monty. Guy was waiting in the SUV. Both assistants waved to Doreen, then they sped away. It was the last Wednesday in September, week 21 of his campaign, and the 21st consecutive Wednesday that he had kissed his wife goodbye at 6 a.m. Tony Zachary could not have found a more disciplined candidate. In the rear seat, Monty handed Ron his daily briefing. One of Tony's deputies in Jackson prepared it during the night and emailed it to Monty at exactly 5 each morning. Page 1 was the schedule. Page 2 was a summary of the three groups he would address that day, along with the names of the important people who would attend. Page 3 had updates from his opponents' campaigns. It was all mainly gossip, but still his favorite part of the briefing. Cleet Coley was last seen addressing a small group of sheriff's deputies in Hancock County, then retiring to the blackjack tables at Pirates Cove. Today, McCarthy is expected to be at work and has no campaign events. Page 4 was the financial summary. Contributions so far totaled $1.7 million, with 75% coming from within the state. Expenditures of $1.8 million. The deficit was of no concern. Tony Zachary knew the heavy money would arrive in October. McCarthy had received $1.4 million, virtually all from trial lawyers. She had spent half of it. The prevailing thought in the Fisk camp was that the trial lawyers were tapped out. They were at the airport. The King Air lifted off at 6:30, and at that moment, Fisk was on the phone to Tony and Jackson. It was their first chat of the day. Everything was running smoothly. Fisk had already reached the point of believing that all campaigns were so effortless. He was always prompt, fresh, prepared, well-rested, well-financed, and ready to move on to the next event. He had little contact with the 24 people under Tony's thumb who sweated the details. Justice McCarthy's version of the daily briefing was a glass of fruit juice with Nat Lester at her Jackson headquarters. She aimed for 8:30 each morning and was fairly prompt. By then, Nat had put in 2 hours and was yelling at people. They had no interest in the whereabouts of her two opponents. They spent little time with poll numbers. Their data showed her running even with Fisk, and that was troubling enough. They quickly reviewed the latest fundraising schemes and talked about potential donors.
"I may have a new problem," she said that morning.
"Only one."
"Do you remember the Frankie Hightower case?"
"Not at this moment, no."
"State trooper was gunned down in Grenada County 5 years ago. He stopped a car for speeding. Inside the car were three black men and a black teenager, Frankie Hightower. Someone opened fire with an assault weapon, and the trooper got hit 8 times. Left him in the middle of Highway 51.
"Let me guess. The court has reached a decision."
"The court is getting close. 6 of my colleagues are ready to affirm the conviction."
"Let me guess. You would like to dissent."
"I'm going to dissent. The kid had inadequate counsel. His defense lawyer was some jackass with no experience and apparently very little intelligence. The trial was a joke. The other three thugs pled for life and pointed the finger at Hightower, who was 16 years old and sitting in the back seat without a gun. Yes, I'm going to dissent."
Nat's sandals hit the floor and he began to pace. Arguing the merits of the case was a waste of time. Arguing the politics of it would take some skill.
"Coley will go ballistic."
"I don't care about Coley. He's a clown."
"Clowns get votes."
"He's not a factor."
"Fisk will receive it as a wonderful gift from God. More proof that his campaign is divinely inspired. Manna from heaven. I can see the ads now."
"I'm dissenting, Nat. It's that simple."
"It's never that simple. Some of the voters might understand what you're doing and admire your courage. Perhaps 3 or 4 of them. The rest will see the Fisk ad with the smiling face of that handsome young state trooper next to the mugshot of Frankie, whatever his name is."
"Hightower."
"Thank you. The ad will refer to liberal judges at least 10 times, and it will probably show your face. Powerful stuff. You might as well quit now."
His words trailed off, but were bitter nonetheless. For a long time, they said nothing. Sheila broke the silence by saying,
"That's not a bad idea.
Quitting. I've caught myself reading the briefs and asking, what will the voters think if I rule this way or that? I'm not a judge anymore, Nat. I'm a politician."
"You're a great judge, Sheila. One of the 3 we have left."
"It's all about politics now."
"You're not quitting. Have you written your dissent?"
"I'm working on it."
"Look, Sheila, the election is 5 weeks away. How slow can you write? Hell, the court is famous for taking its sweet time. Surely to God you can sit on this thing until after the election. What's 5 weeks? It's nothing. The murder was 5 years ago."
He was stomping around, arms flailing.
"We do have a schedule."
"Bullshit. You can manipulate it."
"For politics?"
"Damned right, Sheila. Give me a break here. We're busting our asses for you, and you act like you're too good for the dirty work. This is a filthy business, okay?"
"Lower your voice."
He lowered it several octaves, but kept pacing. 3 steps to one wall, then 3 steps to the other.
"Your dissent is not going to change a damned thing. The court will run over you again 6-3, maybe even 7-2, perhaps even 8-1. The numbers don't really matter. The conviction is affirmed, and Frankie whoever will stay exactly where he is right now and where he'll be 10 years from now. Don't be stupid, Sheila."
She finished her fruit juice and did not respond.
"I don't like that smirk," Nat said.
He pointed a long, bony finger at her.
"Listen to me. If you file a dissent before the election, I'm walking out the door."
"Don't threaten me."
"I'm not threatening. I'm promising. You know 10 different ways to sit on that case for another 5 weeks. Hell, you could bury it for 6 months.
She stood and said, "I'm going to work."
"I'm not kidding," he yelled. "I'll quit."
She yanked the door open and said,
"Go find us some money."
3 days later, the skillfully coordinated avalanche began. Only a handful of people knew what was coming. Ron Fisk himself did not comprehend the scope of his own saturation. He had performed for the cameras, changed into various outfits, worked his way through the scripts, dragged in his family and some friends, and he was aware of the budget and the media buys and the market shares of the various television stations in South Mississippi. And in a normal campaign, he would have worried about financing such expensive marketing. But the machine that bore his name had many parts he knew nothing about. The first ads were the soft ones, warm little vignettes to open the doors and let this fine young man into the homes. Ron, as a Boy Scout, with the richly accented old voice of an actor playing the role of his scoutmaster in the background.
One of the finest Boy Scouts we ever had. He made it to Eagle in less than 3 years.
Ron in a robe at high school graduation, a star student. Ron with Doreen and the kids, and his own voice saying, "Families are our greatest asset." After 30 seconds, the ad signed off with the slogan, in a deep, heavenly voice, "Ron Fisk, a judge with our values." A second ad, a series of black and white still photos, began with Ron on the steps of his church in a fine dark suit chatting with his pastor, who narrated, "Ron Fisk was ordained as a deacon in this church 12 years ago. Ron with his jacket off teaching Sunday school. Ron holding his Bible as he makes a point to a group of teenagers under a shade tree. Thank God for men like Ron Fisk." Ron and Doreen greeting people at the church's door, and the same farewell. "Ron Fisk, a judge with our values." There was not the slightest hint of conflict, nothing about the campaign, not a trace of mud, no indication of the savagery that would follow. Just a charming hello from an incredibly wholesome young deacon. The ads blanketed South Mississippi and Central as well, because Tony Zachary was paying the steep prices charged by the Jackson outlets. September 30th was a crucial date on Barry Reinhart's calendar. All contributions made in the month of October would not be reported until November 10th, 6 days after the election. The flood of out-of-state money he was about to unleash would go undetected until it was too late. The losers would scream, but that was all they could do. On September 30th, Reinhart and company kicked into high gear. They began with their A-list: tort reform groups, right-wing religious organizations, business lobbyists, business PACs, and hundreds of conservative organizations, ranging from the well-known American Rifle Association to the obscure Zero Future Tax, a small gang dedicated to abolishing the Internal Revenue Service. 1,140 groups in all 50 states. Reinhart sent each a detailed memo and request for an immediate donation to the Fisk campaign in the amount of $2,500, the maximum for an organized entity. From this collection, his goal was $500,000. For the individuals' $5,000 maximum gift, Reinhart had a list of 1,000 corporate executives and senior managers of companies in industries that attracted litigation from trial lawyers. Chief among these were insurance companies, and he would collect $1 million from his contacts there. Carl Trudeau had given him the names of 200 executives of companies controlled by the Trudeau Group, though no one from Crane Chemical would write a check. If the Fisk campaign took money from Crane, then a front-page story was likely. Fisk might feel compelled to recuse himself, a disaster Reinhart couldn't begin to contemplate. He expected $1 million from Carl's boys, though it would not go directly into the Fisk campaign. To keep their names away from nosy reporters and to make sure no one ever knew of Mr. Trudeau's involvement, Reinhart routed their money into the bank accounts for Lawsuit Victims for Truth and Gun Owners United Now, GUN. His B list contained 1,000 names of donors with proven records of supporting pro-business candidates, though not at the $5,000 level. He expected another $500,000. $3 million was his goal, and he was not at all concerned about reaching it. Chapter 26. In the excitement of the moment, Huffy had made a dreadful mistake. The expectation of a meaningful payment, coupled with the constant pressure from Mr. Prickhead, had caused a lapse in judgment. Not long after Wes stopped by with the promise of $50,000, Huffy marched into the big office and proudly informed his boss that the Paytons' debt was about to be reduced. When he got the bad news 2 days later that it was not, he was too afraid to tell anyone. After losing sleep for almost a week, he finally forced himself to confront the devil again. He stepped in front of the massive desk, swallowed hard, and said, "Some bad news, sir." "Where's the money?" Mr. Kirkhead demanded.
"It's not going to happen, sir. Their settlement fell through."
Forgoing curse words, Mr. Prickhead said,
"We're calling the loan. Do it now."
"What?
You heard me.
We can't do that. They've been paying $2,000 a month."
"Super. That doesn't even cover the interest. Call the loan now."
"But why?"
"Just a couple of small reasons, Huffy. Number one, it's been in default for at least a year. Number two, it's grossly under-collateralized. As a banker, certainly you can understand these small problems."
"But they're trying."
"Call the loan. Do it now. And if you don't, then you'll be either reassigned or dismissed."
"That's obscene."
"I don't care what you think."
Then he relented a bit and said,
"It's not my decision, Huffy. We have new ownership, and I have been ordered to call the loan."
"But why?"
Kirkhead picked up the phone and offered it.
"You want to call a man in Dallas?
This will bankrupt them."
"They've been bankrupt for a long time. Now they can make it official."
"Son of a bitch."
"Talking to me, son?"
Huffy glared at the fat, hairless head, then said,
"Not really. More to that son of a bitch in Dallas."
"We'll keep that here, okay?"
Huffy returned to his office, slammed the door, and watched the walls while an hour passed. Prickhead would stop by soon for the follow-up. Wes was in a deposition downtown. Mary Grace was at her desk and took the call. She admired Huffy for his bravery in extending much more credit than anyone had thought possible, but the sound of his voice always rattled her.
"Good morning, Tom," she said pleasantly.
"It's not a good morning, Mary Grace," he began. "It's a bad morning, an awful morning, one of the worst ever."
A heavy pause.
"I'm listening."
"The bank, not the bank you've been dealing with, but another bank now, one owned by some people I've met only once and never care to see again, has decided that it can no longer wait to be paid. The bank, not me, is calling the loan."
Mary Grace emitted a strange guttural sound that could have passed for an expletive, but really wasn't a word at all. Her first thought was of her father. Other than the Payton signatures, the only security for the loan was a 200-acre tract of farmland her father had owned for many years. It was near Bowmore, and it did not include the 40 acres and family home. The bank would foreclose on the property.
"Any particular reason, Huffy?" she asked coolly.
"None whatsoever. The decision was not made in Hattiesburg. Second State sold out to the devil, if you will recall."
"This doesn't make sense."
"I agree.
You'll force us into bankruptcy, and the bank will get nothing,
except for the farm."
"So you'll foreclose on the farm?"
"Someone will. I hope not me."
"Smart move, Huffy. Because when they foreclose on the courthouse steps in Bowmore, there might be a killing.
Maybe they'll get old Prickhead."
"Are you in your office?"
"Yes, with the door locked."
"Wes is downtown. He'll be there in 15 minutes. Unlock the door."
"No."
15 minutes later, Wes charged into Huffy's office, his cheeks red with anger, his hands ready to strangle.
"Where's Prickhead?" he demanded.
Huffy jumped to his feet behind his desk and placed both hands in the air.
"Be cool, Wes.
Where's Prickhead?"
Right now he's in his car, driving to an urgent meeting, one that suddenly materialized 10 minutes ago. Sit down, Wes.
Wes took a deep breath, then slowly eased into a chair. Huffy watched him, then returned to his own chair.
It's not his fault, Wes, Huffy said. Technically, the loan has been in default for almost 2 years. He could have done this months ago, but he didn't. I know you don't like him. I don't like him. His wife doesn't like him. But he's been very patient. This was a decision made in the home office. Give me a name at the home office.
Huffy slid across a letter he had received by fax. It was addressed to the Paytons on New Vista Bank letterhead and signed by a Mr. F. Patterson Duval, vice president.
This arrived 30 minutes ago, Huffy said. I don't know Mr. Duval. I've called his office twice, but he's in a very important meeting, one that I'm sure will last until we stop calling. It's a waste of time, Wes.
The letter demanded payment in full of $414,656.22, with daily interest kicking in at $83.50. Pursuant to the terms of the loan agreement, the Paytons had 48 hours to pay, or collection and foreclosure proceedings would commence. Of course, the resulting attorney's fees and court costs would also be tacked onto the amount due. Wes read it slowly as he continued to cool down. He placed it back on the desk. Mary Grace and I talk about this loan every day, Huffy. It's part of our marriage. We talk about the kids, the office, the debt to the bank, what's for dinner. It's always there, and we've busted our asses to pay off all other obligations so we can bust our asses to pay off the bank. We came very close to giving you $50,000 last week. We vowed to work ourselves ragged until this bank is out of our lives. Now this stunt. Now some moron in Dallas has decided he's tired of seeing this past due loan on his daily rap sheet, and he wants to get rid of it. You know what, Huffy?
What?
The bank just screwed itself. We'll file for bankruptcy, and when you try to foreclose on my father-in-law's property, I'll put him in bankruptcy. And when we work our way out of bankruptcy and we're back on our feet, guess who ain't getting paid?
The moron in Dallas?
You got it. The bank gets nothing. It'll be wonderful. We can keep the $400,000 when we earn it. Late that afternoon, Wes and Mary Grace called a firm meeting in the pit. Other than the humiliation of filing for bankruptcy, which seemed to bother no one, there was little to worry about. In fact, the bank's actions would give the firm some breathing room. The $2,000 monthly payments would cease, and the cash could certainly be used elsewhere. The concern, of course, was the land owned by Mr. Shelby, Mary Grace's father. Wes had a plan. He would find a friendly buyer who would appear at the foreclosure and write a check. Title would pass, and it would be held in a handshake trust until the Paytons could buy it back, hopefully within a year. Neither Wes nor Mary Grace could stomach the idea of asking her father to join them at the bankruptcy court. 48 hours passed with no payment. Sticking to its word, the bank filed suit. Its lawyer, a local gentleman the Paytons knew well, called ahead of time and apologized. He had represented the bank for years and could not afford to lose it as a client. Mary Grace accepted his apology and gave him her blessing to sue them. The next day, the Paytons filed for bankruptcy, both individually and as Payton and Payton, attorneys at law. They listed combined assets of $35,000, two old cars, furniture, office equipment, all of which was protected. They listed debts of $420,000. The filing effectively stayed the lawsuit and would eventually render it useless. The Hattiesburg American reported it on its second page the following day. Carl Trudeau read about it online and laughed out loud. "Sue me again," he said with great satisfaction. Within a week, three Hattiesburg law firms informed Old Prickhead that they were withdrawing their funds, closing their accounts, and moving their business down the street. There were at least eight other banks in town. A wealthy trial lawyer named Jim McMay called Wes and offered assistance. The two had been friends for many years and had collaborated twice on product liability cases. McMay represented four Bowmore families in the Crane litigation, but had not pushed the cases aggressively. Like the other trial lawyers suing Crane, he was waiting for the outcome of Baker and hoping to hit the jackpot if and when there was a settlement. They met for breakfast at Nanny's, and over biscuits and country ham, McMay readily agreed to rescue the 200 acres at foreclosure and keep the title until the Paytons could buy it back. Farmland in Cancer County wasn't exactly selling at a premium, and Wes speculated that the Shelby property would fetch around $100,000, the only money the bank would collect from its foolish maneuver. Chapter 27. Sheila McCarthy was enduring the morning's torture on the treadmill when she hit the stop button and gawked at the television in disbelief. The ad ran at 7:29, smack in the middle of the local news. It began with the provocative sight of two well-dressed young men kissing passionately while a minister of some variety smiled behind them. A husky voiceover announced, "Same-sex marriages are sweeping the country. In places like Massachusetts, New York, and California, laws are being challenged. Advocates of gay and lesbian marriages are pushing hard to force their lifestyles on the rest of our society." A still photo of a wedding couple, male and female, at the altar was suddenly desecrated with a bold black X. "Liberal judges are sympathetic to the rights of same-sex marriages." The photo was replaced with a video of a group of happy lesbians waiting to tie the knot in a mass ceremony. "Our families are under attack from homosexual activists and liberal judges who support them." Next was a quick video of a mob burning an American flag. The voice said, "Liberal judges have approved the burning of our flag." Then a quick shot of a magazine rack lined with copies of Hustler. "Liberal judges see nothing wrong with pornography." Then a photo of a smiling family, mother and father and four children. "Will liberal judges destroy our families?" the narrator inquired ominously, leaving little doubt that they would if given half a chance. The family photo was ripped apart into two jagged pieces. Suddenly, the handsome but serious face of Ron Fisk appeared. He looked sincerely at the camera and said, "Not in Mississippi. One man, one woman. I'm Ron Fisk, candidate for the Supreme Court, and I approved this ad." Dripping with sweat, her heart pounding even faster, Sheila sat on the floor and tried to think. The weatherman was prattling on, but she didn't hear him. She lay down on her back, stretched out her arms and legs, and took deep breaths. Gay marriage was a dead issue in Mississippi and would remain so forever. No one with an audience or a following had dared to suggest that the laws be changed to allow it. Every member of the state legislature could be expected to rail against it. Only one judge in the entire state, Phil Shingleton, had addressed it, and he had dismissed the Meyercheck-Spano lawsuit in record speed. The Supreme Court would probably deal with that case in a year or so, but Sheila expected a rather terse review followed by a quick 9-0 vote affirming Judge Shingleton. How exactly had she now been cast as a liberal judge who supported gay marriage? The room was spinning. At a commercial break, she tensed and waited for another assault, but there was nothing but the squawking of a car dealer and frantic urgings of a discount furniture retailer. 15 minutes later, though, the ad was back. She lifted her head and watched in disbelief as the same images followed the same voice. Her phone was ringing. Caller ID told her not to answer. She showered and dressed in a hurry, and at 8:30 walked into her headquarters with a wide smile and warm, "Good morning." The four volunteers were subdued. Three televisions were running three different programs. Nat was in his office yelling at someone on the phone. He slammed the phone down, waved her inside, then closed the door behind her.
You've seen it, he said.
Twice, she said softly. On the surface, she seemed unfazed. Everyone else was rattled, and it was important to at least try to appear calm.
Total saturation, he said. Jackson, Gulf Coast, Hattiesburg, Laurel, every 15 minutes on all stations, plus radio.
What kind of juice do you have?
Carrot, he said and opened his small refrigerator. They're burning money, which of course means they're raking it in by the truckload. Typical ambush. Wait until October 1st, then push the button and start printing cash. They did it last year in Illinois and Alabama, 2 years ago in Ohio and Texas.
He poured two cups as he spoke. Sit down and relax, Nat, she said. He did not.
Attack ads must be answered in kind, he said, and quickly.
I'm not sure this is an attack ad. He never mentions my name.
He doesn't have to. How many liberal judges are running against Mr. Fisk?
None that I know of.
As of this morning, dear, you are now officially a liberal judge.
Really? I don't feel any different.
We have to answer this, Sheila.
I'm not getting dragged into a mudslinging fight over gay marriage. Nat finally wiggled himself into his chair and shut up. He drank his juice, stared at the floor, and waited for his breathing to relax. She took a sip of carrot juice, then said with a smile, "This is deadly, isn't it?"
The juice?
The ad.
Potentially, yes, but I'm working on something.
He reached into a pile of rubble next to his desk and pulled out a thin file. He opened it and lifted three sheets of paper clipped together.
Listen to this. Mr. Meyerchick and Mr. Spano leased an apartment on April 1st of this year. We have a copy of the lease. They waited 30 days as required by law, then registered to vote. The next day, May 2nd, they applied for Mississippi driver's licenses, took the exam, and passed. The Department of Public Safety issued licenses on May 4th. A couple of months passed, during which there is no record of employment, business licenses, nothing official to indicate they were working here. Remember, they claim to be self-employed illustrators, whatever the hell that is.
He was riffling through the papers, checking facts here and there.
A survey of the illustrators who advertise various services in the Yellow Pages revealed that no one knows Meyerchick or Spano. Their apartment is in a big complex, lots of units, lots of neighbors, none of whom can remember seeing them. In gay circles, not a single person who was contacted has ever met them.
Contacted by whom?
Hang on. Then they try to get a marriage license, and the rest of the story has been in the newspapers.
Contacted by whom? Nat arranged the papers in the file and closed it.
This is where it gets interesting. Last week, I received a call from a young man who described himself as a gay law student here in Jackson. He gave me his name and the name of his partner, another law student. They're not in the closet, but not exactly ready for the gay pride parade. They were intrigued by the Meyerchick-Spano case, and when it exploded into a campaign issue, they, like a few other folks with brains, began to get suspicious. They know a lot of the gays here in town, and they began to ask about Meyerchick and Spano. No one knows them. In fact, the gay community was suspicious from the day the lawsuit was filed. Who are these guys? Where did they come from? The law students decided to find the answers. They've called the Meyerchick-Spano phone number 5 times a day at different hours and never gotten an answer. For 36 days now, they've made their calls. No answer. They've talked to the neighbors. Never a sighting. No one saw them move in. They've knocked on the door, peeked in the windows. The apartment is barely furnished, nothing on the walls. To make themselves real citizens, Meyerchick and Spano paid $3,000 for a used Saab, titled in both names like a real married couple, then bought Mississippi car tags. The Saab is parked in front of their apartment and hasn't moved in 36 days.
Where might this be going? She asked.
I'm getting there. Now, our two law students have found them in Chicago, where Meyerchick owns a gay bar and Spano works as an interior designer. The students are willing, for little cash,
to fly to Chicago, spend a few days, hang out in the bar, infiltrate, gather information. Information for what? Information that, hopefully, will prove that they are not residents of this state, that their presence here was a sham, that someone is using them to exploit the gay marriage issue, and maybe that they are not even a couple in Chicago. If we can prove that, then I'll go to the Clarion Ledger, the Biloxi Sun-Herald, and every other newspaper in the state and deliver the goods. We can't win a fight on this issue, dear, but we can damn sure fight back.
She drained her glass and shook her head in disbelief.
Do you think Fisk is this smart?
Fisk is a pawn. But yes, his handlers are this smart. It's a cynical scheme, and it's brilliant. No one thinks about gay marriage here because it will never happen. Then suddenly, everybody's talking about it. Front page news. Everybody's scared. Mothers are hiding their children. Politicians are blathering.
But why use two gay men from Chicago?
I'm not sure you can find two gay men in Mississippi who want this kind of publicity. Plus, gays here who are committed to tolerance understand the backlash from the straight world. The worst thing they could do is exactly what Meyercheck and Spano have done.
If Meyercheck and Spano are gay, why would they do something to hurt the cause?
Two reasons. First, they don't live here. Second, money. Someone's paying the bills. The apartment lease, the used car, the lawyer, and a few $1,000 to Meyercheck and Spano for their time and trouble.
Sheila had heard enough. She glanced at her watch and said,
"How much do they need?"
"Expense money. Airfare, hotel, the basics. $2,000.
"Do we have it?"
she asked with a laugh.
"It's out of my pocket. We'll keep it off the books. I just want you to know what we're doing."
"You have my approval."
"And the Frankie Hightower descent?"
"I'm hard at work. Should take me another 2 months."
"Now you're talking like a real Supreme Court justice."
Denny Ott received a left-handed invitation to the meeting when a fellow preacher mentioned it to him over coffee one morning at Babe's. Not every minister in town was invited. Two from the Methodist churches and the Presbyterian pastor were specifically excluded, but it appeared as if all others were welcome. There was no Episcopal church in Bowmore, and if the town had a single Catholic, he or she had yet to come forward. It was held on a Thursday afternoon in the fellowship hall of a fundamentalist congregation called Harvest Tabernacle. The moderator was the church's pastor, a fiery young man who was generally known as Brother Ted. After a quick prayer, he welcomed his fellow ministers, 16 in number, including 3 black ministers. He cast a wary eye at Denny Ott, but said nothing about his presence. Brother Ted quickly got down to business. He had joined the Brotherhood Coalition, a newly formed collection of fundamentalist preachers throughout South Mississippi. It was their purpose to quietly and methodically do everything possible within the Lord's will to elect Ron Fisk and thus kill off any chance of same-sex marriages occurring in Mississippi. He ranted on about the evils of homosexuality and its growing acceptability in American society. He quoted the Bible when appropriate, his voice rising with indignation when necessary. He stressed the urgency of electing godly men to all public positions and promised that the Brotherhood would be a force for years to come. Denny listened with a straight face, but growing alarm. He had had several conversations with the Paytons and knew the real issues behind the race. The manipulation and marketing of Fisk made him sick. He glanced at the other ministers and wondered how many funerals they had held for people killed by Crane Chemical. Carey County should be the last place to embrace the candidacy of someone like Ron Fisk. Brother Ted grew sufficiently pious when he moved to the subject of Sheila McCarthy. She was a Catholic from the coast, which in rural Christian circles meant she was a woman of loose morals. She was divorced, she liked to party, and there were rumors of boyfriends. She was a hopeless liberal, opposed to the death penalty, and could not be trusted when faced with decisions dealing with gay marriage and illegal immigration and the like. When he finished his sermon,
Someone suggested that perhaps churches should not become so involved in politics. This was met with general disapproval. Brother Ted jumped in with a brief lecture about the culture wars and the courage they should have to fight for God. It's time for Christians to get off the sidelines and charge into the arena. This led to a fervent discussion about the erosion of values. Blame was placed on television, Hollywood, the internet. The list grew long and ugly. What was their strategy, someone asked? Organization. Church folk outnumbered the heathen in South Mississippi, and the troops must be mobilized. Campaign workers, door knockers, poll watchers spread the message from church to church, house to house. The election was only 3 weeks away. Their movement was spreading like wildfire. After an hour, Deniot could take no more. He excused himself, drove to his office at the church, and called Mary Grace. The MTA directors met in an emergency session 2 days after the Fisk campaign launched its waves of anti-gay marriage ads. The mood was somber. The question was obvious. How did such an issue take center stage, and what could the McCarthy campaign do to counter the attack? Nat Lester was present and gave a summary of their plans for the final 3 weeks. McCarthy had $700,000 to fight with, much less than Fisk. Half of her budget was already committed to television ads that would begin running in 24 hours. The remainder was for direct mail and some last-minute radio and TV spots. After that, they were out of money. Small donations were coming from labor, conservationists, good government groups, and a few of the more moderate lobbying organizations, but 92% of McCarthy's funds were mailed in by trial lawyers. Nat then summarized the latest poll. The race was a dead heat with the two frontrunners at 30%, with the same number of voters still undecided. Coley remained around 10%. However, the poll was conducted the week before and did not reflect any shift due to the gay marriage ads. Because of those ads, Nat would begin polling over the weekend. Not surprisingly, the trial lawyers had wild and varied opinions about what to do. All of their ideas were expensive, Nat continually reminded them. He listened to them argue. Some had sensible ideas, others were radical. Most assumed they knew more about campaigns than the others, and all of them took for granted that whatever course of action they finally agreed on would be immediately embraced by the McCarthy campaign. Nat did not share with them some depressing gossip. A reporter from the Biloxi newspaper had called that morning with a few questions. He was exploring a story about the raging new issue of same-sex marriages. During the course of a 10-minute interview, he told Nat that the largest television station on the coast had sold $1 million in prime airtime to the Fisk campaign for the remaining 3 weeks. It was believed to be the largest sale ever in a political race. $1 million on the coast meant at least that much for the rest of the markets. The news was so distressing that Nat was debating whether to tell Sheila. At that moment, he was leaning toward keeping it to himself, and he certainly wouldn't share it with the trial lawyers. Such sums were so staggering, it might demoralize Sheila's base. The MTA president, Bobby Neal, finally hammered out a plan, one that would cost little. He would send to their 800 members an urgent email detailing the dire situation and begging for action. Each trial lawyer would be instructed to, 1, make a list of at least 10 clients who were willing and able to write a check for $100, and 2, make another list of clients and friends who could be motivated to campaign door-to-door and work the polls on election day. Grassroots support was critical. As the meeting began to break up, Willie Benton stood at the far end of the table and got everyone's attention. He was holding a sheet of paper with small print front and back. "This is a promissory note on a line of credit at the Gulf Bank in Pascagoula," he announced, and more than one lawyer considered diving under the table. Benton was no small thinker, and he was known for drama. "$500,000, he said slowly. the numbers booming around the room. In favor of the campaign to re-elect Sheila McCarthy. I've already signed it, and I'm going to pass it around this table. There are 12 of us here. It requires 10 signatures to become effective. Each will be liable for $50,000.
Dead silence. Eyes were darting from face to face. Some had already contributed more than $50,000. Others much less. Some would spend $50,000 on jet fuel next month. Others were bickering with their creditors. Regardless of their bank balances at the moment, each and every one wanted to strangle the little bastard. Benton handed the note to the unlucky stiff to his left, one without a jet. Fortunately, such moments in a career are rare. Sign it, and you're a tough guy who can roll the dice. Pass it along unsigned, and you might as well quit and go home and do real estate. All 12 signed. Chapter 28. The pervert's name was Darrell Sackett. When last seen, he was 37 years old and housed in a county jail awaiting a new trial on charges of molesting small children. He certainly looked guilty. Long sloping forehead, vapid bug eyes enlarged by thick glasses, splotchy stubble from a week's growth, a thick scar stuck to his chin. The type of face that would alarm any parent, or anyone else for that matter. A career pedophile, he was first arrested at age 16. Many other arrests followed, and he had been convicted at least 4 times in 4 different states. Sackett, with his frightening face and disgusting rap sheet, was introduced to the registered voters of South Mississippi in a snazzy direct mailing from another new organization, this one calling itself Victims Rising. The 2-page letter was both a bio of a pathetic criminal and a summary of the miserable failures of the judicial system. "Why is this man free?" the letter screamed. Answer? Because Justice Sheila McCarthy overturned his conviction on 16 counts of child molestation. 8 years earlier, a jury convicted Sackett, and the judge sentenced him to life without parole. His lawyer, one paid by taxpayers, appealed his case to the Supreme Court, and there Darrell Sackett found the sympathetic embrace of Justice Sheila McCarthy. McCarthy condemned the honest and hard-working detectives who extracted a full confession from Sackett. She chastised them for what she saw as their faulty search and seizure methods. She hammered the trial judge, who was highly respected and tough on crime, for admitting into evidence the confession and materials taken from Sackett's apartment. The jury was visibly shaken when forced to view Sackett's stash of child porn seized by the cops during a valid search. She claimed distaste for the defendant, but begged off by saying that she had no choice but to reverse his conviction and send his case back for a new trial. Sackett was moved from the state prison back to the Lauderdale County Jail, where he escaped 1 week later. He had not been heard from since. He was out there, a free man, no doubt continuing his violence against innocent children. The last paragraph ended with the usual rant against liberal judges. The fine print gave the standard approval by Ron Fisk. Certain relevant facts were conveniently omitted. First, the court voted 8-1 to reverse the Sackett conviction and send it back for a new trial. The actions of the police were so egregious that 4 other justices wrote concurring opinions that were even more scathing in their condemnation of the forced confession and warrantless unconstitutional search. The lone dissenter, Justice Romano, was a misguided soul who had never voted to reverse a criminal conviction and privately vowed that he would never do so. Second, Sackett was dead. 4 years earlier, he had been killed in a bar fight in Alaska. The news of his passing barely made it to Mississippi, and when his file was retired in Lauderdale County, not a single reporter noticed. Barry Reinhart's exhaustive research discovered the truth, for what little it mattered. The Fisk campaign was far beyond the truth now.
The candidate was too busy to sweat the details, and he had placed his complete trust in Tony Zachary. The race had become a crusade, a calling of the highest order, and if facts were slightly bent or even ignored, then it was justified because of the importance of his candidacy. Besides, it was politics, a dirty game, and you could rest assured the other side wasn't playing fair either. Barry Reinhardt had never been shackled by the truth. His only concern was not getting caught in his lies. If a madman like Darrell Sackett was out there on the loose, very much alive, and doing his filthy deeds, then his story was more shocking. A dead Sackett was a pleasant thought, but Reinhardt preferred the power of fear, and he knew that McCarthy couldn't respond. She had reversed his conviction, plain and simple. Any effort to explain why would be futile in the world of 30-second ads and snappy sound bites. After the shock of the ad, she would try to erase Sackett from her mind. After the shock, though, she had to at least revisit the case. She saw the ad online at the Victims Rising website after receiving a frantic call from Nat Lester. Paul, her clerk, found the reported case, and they read it in silence. She vaguely remembered it. In the 8 years since, she had read 1,000 briefs and written hundreds of opinions. "You got it right," Paul said when he finished. "Yes, but why does it look so wrong now?" she said. She had been hard at work at her desk, covered with memos from half a dozen cases. She was stunned, bewildered. He didn't answer. "I wonder what's next," she said, closing her eyes. "Probably a death penalty case, and they'll cherry-pick the facts again." "Thanks. Anything else?" "Sure. There's lots of material in these books. You're a judge. Every time you make a decision, someone loses. These guys don't care about the truth, so they can make anything sound bad." "Please shut up." Her first ads began, and they lightened the mood somewhat. Nat chose to begin with a straightforward piece with Sheila in a black robe sitting at the bench, smiling earnestly at the camera. She talked about her experience, 8 years as a trial judge in Harrison County, 9 years on the Supreme Court. She hated to pat her own back, but twice in the past 5 years, she had received the highest rating in the state bar's annual review of all appellate judges. She was not a liberal judge, nor a conservative one. She refused to be labeled. Her commitment was simply to follow the laws of Mississippi, not to make new ones. The best judges are those without agendas, without preconceived notions of how they might rule. The best judges are those with experience. Neither of her opponents had ever presided over a trial, or issued a ruling, or studied complicated briefs, or listened to oral arguments, or written a final opinion. Until now, neither of her opponents had shown the slightest interest in sitting as a judge. Yet they are asking the voters to jumpstart their judicial careers at the very top. She finished by saying, without the smile, "I was appointed to this position by the governor 9 years ago. Then I was reelected by you, the people. I am a judge, not a politician, and I don't have the money that some are spending to purchase this seat. I ask you, the voters, to help send the message that a seat on the Mississippi Supreme Court cannot be bought by big business. Thank you." Nat spent little money at the Jackson stations and much more on the coast. McCarthy would never be able to saturate like Fisk. Nat speculated that Fisk and all those wealthy folks behind him were burning $200,000 a week on the anti-gay marriage ads alone. Sheila's first round was about half of that, and the response was lukewarm. The ad was called Uncreative by her coordinator in Jackson County. A noisy trial lawyer, no doubt an expert in all things political, sent an angry email in which he blasted Nat for such a soft approach. "You gotta fight fire with fire and answer the attack ads with more of the same." He reminded Nat that his firm had contributed $30,000 and might forego any more if McCarthy didn't take off the gloves. Women seemed to like the ad. Men were more critical. After reading a few dozen emails, Matt realized he was wasting his time. Barry Reinhardt had been waiting impatiently for some television from the McCarthy strategists. When he finally saw her first ad, he laughed out loud. What an old-fashioned, out-of-date, pathetically lame effort. Judge in black robe, at a bench, thick law books as props, even a gavel for good measure. She looked sincere, but she was a judge, not a television presence. Her eyes moved as she read from the teleprompter. Her head was as rigid as a deer in headlights. A weak response indeed, but it had to be answered. It had to be buried. Reinhardt reached into his video library, his arsenal, and selected his next grenade. 10 hours after McCarthy began running her ad, she was blown off the television by an attack ad that stunned even the most jaded political junkies. It began with the sharp crack of a rifle shot, then a black-and-white photo of Justice McCarthy, one from the court's official website. A powerful, barbed voice announced, "Justice Sheila McCarthy does not like hunters." 7 years ago, she wrote, "The hunters of this state have a poor record on safety." This quote was splashed across her face. The photo changed to one from a newspaper story with Sheila shaking hands at a rally. The voice continued, "And Justice Sheila McCarthy does not like gun owners." 5 years ago, she wrote, "The ever-vigilant gun lobby can always be expected to attack any statute that might in any way restrict the use of handguns in vulnerable areas. Regardless of how sensible a proposed statute might be, the gun lobby will descend upon it with a vengeance." This, too, was printed rapidly, word for word, across the screen. Then there was another blast, this one from a shotgun firing at a blue sky. Ron Fisk appeared, decked out like the real hunter he was. He lowered his shotgun and chatted with the voters for a few seconds. Memories of his grandfather hunting in these woods as a child, love of nature, a vow to protect the sacred rights of hunters and gun owners. It ended with Ron walking along the edge of the woods, a pack of frisky dogs behind him. Some small, quick print at the end of the ad gave credit to an organization called Gun Owners United Now, GUN. The truth? The first case mentioned in the ad involved the accidental shooting of a deer hunter. His widow sued the man who shot him. A nasty trial ensued, and the jury in Calhoun County awarded her $600,000, the highest ever in that courtroom. The trial was as sordid as a divorce, with allegations of drinking and pot smoking and bad behavior. The two men were members of a hunting club and had been at deer camp for a week. During the trial, a contentious issue was safety, and several experts testified about gun laws and hunter education. Though the evidence was hotly disputed, it appeared from the record that the bulk of the testimony proved that the state's record on safety lagged behind others. In the second case, the city of Tupelo, in response to a schoolyard shooting that killed none but injured four, passed an ordinance banning the possession of a firearm within 100 yards of any public school. Gun advocates sued, and the American Rifle Association wedged itself into the picture by filing a portentous and overblown friend of the court brief. The court struck down the ordinance on Second Amendment grounds, but Sheila dissented. In doing so, she couldn't resist the temptation to take a swipe at the ARA. Now the swipe was back. She watched Fisk's latest ad in her office alone, and with the sinking feeling that her chances were fading. On the stump, she had the time to explain her votes and point out the unfairness of taking her words out of context. But on television, she had 30 seconds. It was impossible, and the clever handlers of Ron Fisk knew it. After a month at Pirate's Cove, Cleet Coley had overstayed his welcome. The owner was fed up with giving away a penthouse suite and he was fed up with feeding Coley's astounding appetite. The candidate was getting 3 meals a day, many of them sent to his room. At the blackjack tables, he drank rum like it was water and got hammered every night. He badgered the dealers, insulted the other players, and groped the cocktail waitresses. The casino had pocketed about $20,000 from Coley, but his expenses were at least that much. Marlon found him at the bar early one evening having a drink, limbering up for another long night at the tables. After small talk, Marlon cut to the chase.
"We'd like for you to drop out of the race," he said, "and while you're leaving, endorse Ron Fisk."
Cleet's eyes narrowed, deep wrinkles tightened around his forehead.
"Say what? You heard me."
"I'm not so sure I did."
"We're asking you to withdraw and endorse Fisk. It's simple."
Coley gulped the rum without taking his eyes off Marlon.
"Keep talking," he said.
"There's not much to say. You're a long shot, to put it mildly. You've done a good job of stirring things up, attacking McCarthy, but it's time to bail out and help elect Fisk."
"What if I don't like Fisk?"
"I'm sure he doesn't like you. It's immaterial. The party's over. You've had your jollies, gotten some headlines, met lots of interesting folks along the way, but you've made your last speech. The ballots have been printed. My name is on them. That means that a handful of your fans won't hear the news. Big deal."
Another long pull on the rum, and Coley said,
"Okay, $100,000 to get in. How much to get out?"
"$50,000.
He shook his head and glanced at the blackjack tables in the distance.
"That's not enough."
"I'm not here to negotiate. It's $50,000 cash, same suitcase as before, just not as heavy."
"Sorry, my figure is $100,000.
I'll be here tomorrow, same time, same place." And with that, Marlon disappeared.
At 9 the next morning, 2 FBI agents banged on the door to the penthouse suite. Eventually, Cleet staggered to the door and demanded,
"Who the hell is it?
FBI, open up."
Cleet cracked the door and peered over the chain. Twins, dark suits, same barber.
"What do you want?"
"We'd like to ask you some questions, and we prefer not to do it from this side of the door."
Cleet opened it and waved them in. He was wearing a t-shirt and a pair of NBA-style shorts that fell to his knees and sagged halfway down his ass. As he watched them sit at the small dining table, he racked his muddled brain for some recollection of which law he'd broken. Nothing recent sprang to mind, but then nothing would at this miserable time of the day.